to the Mixtape with Scott. This is Scott Cunningham, professor at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I think we're on the either the 91st or 92nd. I think this is the 92nd episode. Three seasons, 92 interviews. Really fantastic. Thanks so much for coming and listening. Those of you that still are hanging in there and listening to this thing. It's been a lot of fun for me. And I hope it's been a lot of fun for you too. This week's guest is Jesse Rothstein, the Carmel P. Friesen Professor of Public Policy, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's very, very well-known labor economist. And I won't go into all the superlatives, but you know, he's kind of that, kind of comes from, it's kind of been associated with all the great labor departments, you know, in my mind, a lot of the great labor departments like the University of California, Berkeley, and also Princeton. And so it's, but another thing about talking with Jesse that I was really excited about is he's a David Card student. And as those of you know, not only am I really interested in, you know, I'm very interested in, you know, the causal inference, intellectual social history, but I'm very interested in the students. I'm very interested in how this paradigm shift moved through economics via the students, not just the people that won this Nobel Prize, but through the kind of work that the students did and the colleagues. And so it was really fun talking to Jesse, you know, that's like a hook for me into talking with people, but it was really wonderful talking to Jesse. We had never met formally. We'd spoken a few times, and I teach his augmented synthetic control paper all the time. And I think it's probably one of my favorite papers in that branch of the synth literature, the synth literature not being nearly as, I guess, you know, you, well, it's, it actually is probably getting to be as large as that difference in differences literature. As both of those, the econometrics of diff and diff and the econometrics of synth continue to evolve, you're starting to see that the use cases for the methods, put aside the econometric of the methods, but the reasons that you would use one of them, it's becoming the case that you could justify it, that you could justify the other just as well. The world's getting complicated. The econometric, you know, the causal inference program evaluation is complex. It's complicated. And so anyway, Jesse's written a lot of great papers in labor, education, discrimination, but he's also got these very cool new papers on synthetic control that I really love with Eli Ben Michael and Avi Feller. So I hope you enjoy it. I hope you like this interview. If you do, tell somebody about it. And I'll see you next week. I'm going to turn it over right now to the other Scott Cunningham and from just a few minutes ago, and Dr. Jesse Rothstein. Thanks a lot. All right. Well, it is my pleasure to have with me someone we've emailed briefly recently, but we've spoken. Jesse Rothstein. Jesse, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you in person. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for the sake of the listener, could you tell us your full job title and who pays your salary?
Sure. I teach at the University of California, Berkeley, where I'm the Carmel P. Friesen Chair in Public Policy and Economics.
Oh, okay.
And I also wear another hat where I'm the Faculty Director of the California Policy Lab at Berkeley.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait to talk to you about those things. Okay. Well, let's start with an icebreaker. What's a vacation that you took ever? When you were little, it could have been recently. It doesn't have to have been your favorite vacation. It could even have been your worst vacation, but it's something that you've thought about a couple of times since then.
Interesting. I think a couple of years ago, it must have been 2021, I took my family to Glacier National Park. And that was
Oh.
that's just a spectacular place. I'd been there when I was like 20, and taking my kids back there was just great.
Oh wow,
Just
what'd your kid
beautiful.
how old were your kids?
They were like, I don't know, 13 and 11 then.
Yeah, what'd they think?
They liked it. They liked it. You know, some of the hikes were a bit much for them, and we didn't get into the backcountry or anything like that. But it's,
Oh.
but one reason I keep thinking about it is because they're gonna have to rename it because all the glaciers are disappearing.
Oh, really? What are they going to call it now?
I don't know, but it's gonna be strange to have a glacier national park with no glaciers.
Yeah, that's going to be a big bummer if you go there and there's
Yeah.
nothing, you can't find any. Well,
Yeah.
cool. Well, that's great. Well, so tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in LA in
Oh,
Santa Monica.
okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My dad at the time was a union organizer. My
Oh.
mom did a number of different things, but when I was in high school, she ran a community center that provided a homeless shelter and a battered women's shelter and a number of other kind of
Oh,
community services.
so you kind of come from a background of people that are, your dad being in working for unions, labor was a big part of your, it's like in your DNA a
Yeah.
little bit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my parents were part of the 60s New Left. I think they, you know, they, my mom went to jail in Mississippi for registering black voters.
Oh,
And that
wow.
was that kind of idea that you have your job is to make the country a better place was kind of part of my growing up.
Wow, that's got to be pretty formative. Did you have any siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister.
Oh, okay. So what kind of games were you, what kind of games did you like to play when you were like maybe a little kid?
Yeah. So I know in high school I got into board games with a good friend of mine, a bunch of Axis and Allies, and I forget what all the other ones were called. There are various kind of complicated board games that now my kids are into, and they're way too complicated for me now. But
Yeah.
when I was 14, I loved them.
Yeah. Those are great because they're great. They're so social and they're so,
Yeah.
it requires so much thinking too, but they're so great just being
Exactly.
all around the table.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, when you're in high school, when there's not that many things you can do, it's a way to hang out with your friends all day and have a good
Right.
time.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Those games also take a long time. So it's a lot of fun just hanging out.
Yeah.
Well, so when you were, around those ages, like early, middle school, did you ever have thoughts like, this is what I want to be when I grow up?
I didn't really worry too much about what I wanted to be when I was at that age.
Mm.
I guess I figured it would work itself out, and I didn't know, and I didn't have, there wasn't something I was dying to do,
Mm.
and I figured it would take care of itself. You know, I was always good at math, and I went on to be a math major, and I knew enough about the world to work to know that that would probably put me in a pretty good place, even if I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah, was the math options at your high school pretty good?
I think they were normal. You know, it was a good school, and so I could take calculus, but there
Mm.
wasn't anything unusual, I think, about it.
Yeah. What would your teachers, if I could have eavesdropped in the teachers' lounge, what do you think I would have heard them saying about you?
So I had one teacher who complained that I corrected her too much, in elementary school. Yeah, I don't know. I think they thought I was engaged and bright, but I don't know that any of them would have predicted I'd become an economist. I certainly wouldn't have.
Yeah, had you heard of that kind of thing in high school?
I'd heard of it, but it wasn't, I didn't know much about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I knew growing up, I was always interested in policy and politics,
Ah.
and I knew I liked to do math. And it took me a while to understand that this was a way to combine those two, but
You mean like so from early on, it felt a little bit like that would have been picking between things, and so you picked math.
yeah, I mean, not thinking I was going to become a mathematician or that I was going to do that forever, but I liked doing it, and it was something to study in college. One of the reasons I majored in math was a sense that it required fewer courses than a lot of the other majors.
Oh, really?
And so I had already done a good chunk of them by the end of sophomore year. And so I was really done with my major midway through junior year.
Oh.
And that meant I could take all kinds of things. And
Yeah.
so I took history and I took literature and philosophy.
Oh. Oh, did you take any economics?
I took one economics class in college and hated it.
Was it that EC10 class?
Yep.
You
Yep. It
hated it.
was,
Wow. Was that
I hated
Marty?
it.
Who taught it?
It was Marty Feldstein. I was, you know, I was, I thought of myself, I was fairly progressive,
Mm.
politically, and saw economics in the 90s was kind of still at the ascendance of Chicago school style economics. The first lecture, Marty gave a lecture about how it was really important to distinguish between positive and normative analyses. And this class was going to be entirely about positive analyses, and he wasn't going to make any value judgments. And that was key to economics. And then every other lecture of the semester, he trampled all over that distinction.
Like, what's an example that you really stunned you?
Talking about, you know, the importance of low taxes, how we need to lower tax rates, or we need to lower corporate taxes, or free trade, you know, any of these, you can talk about benefits, you can talk about costs, and then, you know, if you're really just positive, then you leave it to somebody else to decide whether the costs outweigh the benefits. But that wasn't how that class worked. It didn't help that the class was taught mostly by the TAs. That's the way it was set up then. And my TA was a Harvard Business School student who wore a Harvard tie every day. Not and was very, you know, it just felt this wasn't what I was interested in doing.
Wow. So then you take all these math courses and you really thrive. What, so if I could have, like, eavesdropped on the math faculty lounge, the whatever their teacher lounge is, what are they saying about the young Jesse Rothstein, like, towards
I
that,
don't
towards the end?
think anyone knew who I was. You know, I went through college and didn't really stick my head up. I enjoyed it, and I had good friends, and I learned a lot, but I didn't really get to know any of my professors. So, you know, I wrote a senior thesis, so I guess my thesis advisor on a good day would have remembered who I was, but that was about it.
You didn't think about going to grad school and becoming a mathematician?
No, I was good at math, but I wasn't that good at math. And it was pretty clear, you know, freshman year that I wasn't good enough to do that. And that was never something I aspired to. I wasn't hurt by that.
So towards the end of your time at Harvard, is there some sort of future that you're sort of, like, zeroing in on?
No, I had still no idea. I remember feeling like for one, like there were certain kinds of jobs that recruited on college campuses. And at the time, a lot of that was management consulting, but some Wall Street kinds of things. And I knew I didn't want to do any of those. And so I had this resolve that I wasn't going to really even seriously try to look until I graduated for a job. But I remember feeling like that was scary because all my friends knew what they were doing and I had no idea. I applied to do Teach for America and didn't get it, and they were right not to take me.
How come?
Because I hadn't done any teaching.
Oh.
It wasn't, you know, I'd done some tutoring, but I wasn't, you know, there's no, I don't, I think it was reasonable to conclude that I wasn't the right person for them. It was in the early stages of Teach for America where they were pretty choosy.
I see. So what kind of stuff are you looking for? You're looking for, so how would you describe the reasons you're looking at something like Teach for America? What's going on?
I mean, I'm wanting to do something to see, to explore the world a little bit, and also to be helpful. And I thought of, you know, I could explore teaching, I could contribute in some small way and grow up a little bit. But you know, so the other things I applied for were all like going abroad. teaching somewhere,
Oh.
and that's what I ended up doing. I taught English in Japan after college.
Oh, okay. I didn't see that. I thought I saw you
Yeah,
said that.
my CV doesn't have all of the stuff I did bouncing around after college on
Okay.
it.
So you were teaching English as a second language in Japan.
Exactly.
Yeah. How long did you do that for?
Less than a year. It was a it in the days before the Japanese bubble popped, they had a lot of money, and there were a lot of people who wanted to learn English as a kind of a vanity project, and they would hire anybody who'd come do it. If you came from the US, you had to have a college degree because that's what it took to get a visa. But
Oh.
there were other people who were doing it from Australia or New Zealand without that.
Wow.
And so I was teaching for this company that was mostly entertainment, not really teaching.
What do you mean?
So people would sign up for these lessons and they'd come occasionally. And a lot of the appeal was in a period when Japan was pretty closed, they would get to kind of sit and talk with a foreigner for an hour. And that seemed to be why they did it. If you were really serious about learning the language, there were probably more serious options for that.
Yeah. So what did that experience do to you think?
I mean, I would say mostly what I got out of it was just living in Japan and being in a foreign country. When I got off the plane there, I had never eaten sushi. I didn't know a word of Japanese. I learned a little bit of Japanese and I learned to like sushi, but it was an experience living in a place where you really couldn't speak the language and kind of navigating your way around. And it was not always comfortable, but I got a lot out of it.
So you leave. Is it always just going to be a 1 year gig, or is it like you left prematurely?
It could have been longer, but there was no promise to go for longer than I did. And so I went and checked it out and did it for a while. And there were some people who kind of became lifers, but that wasn't ever on my plan. But I didn't
Well,
know what I was going to do next.
the thing I saw is this Economic Policy Institute gig as a researcher. What was that? That's after that experience?
That's after there was something else in between, but yeah, that was after
Oh, what'd
I
you do before that?
so I came back in, what was it? It would have been kind of late spring 1996. And I thought, well, there's these campaigns going, why don't I go work on a political campaign?
Oh, okay.
And so I went to the some trainings for potential campaign staffers. I got slotted into something that they called Voter File Manager, which was basically managing a database at a time when the technology made that a hard thing to do. And I ended up getting a job in New Jersey as helping to manage the database for campaigns and
Was that
campaign
like your
events.
first time to be working with data?
In high school, I had a job working at a local nonprofit, kind of hand entering the receipts from their in-kind donations. So I kind of built a database, but it wasn't any real. It was really just data entry. So this was kind of getting a little bit more involved in it.
What do you think? How did it feel doing all that stuff?
It was interesting. I mean, the technology was just, it's hard to imagine today. If we actually, the idea was that the campaigns might want to get a list of voters who met some characteristics so that they could go kind of walk to their houses or send them a mail-in. And there was a company that the Democratic National Committee had contracted to build these databases for these voter files for all the states. And my job was to interface between the campaigns and that company. But the company had all the voter files on these giant magnetic tapes. So to even do a query would take several days to just, and so the campaigns would say, well, look, we have a budget of this amount. We want to kind of get a list of voters who meet these criteria. But we don't know if we can meet that budget. And it was basically a week-long process to get an answer from the company about how much that would even cost, let alone to generate the list. And so I did a little bit of estimating what it would cost, but a lot of being the kind of point of contact for campaigns that were angry that they weren't getting what they needed out of the database.
What was the cost? It was labor?
The cost to get the list, I actually don't know where the contractor was getting the cost. I mean, it would have been labor. I assume they were covering the fixed cost of the computing, which was, this isn't just buying a laptop in those days. They had a giant room with these, magnetic tapes as big as I was.
Right. Yeah. So, well, then you end up, so what, so you kind of are not, you're not moving in the direction, it sounds like, of like what, like staying on, working on campaigns or something like that. Was that what you were thinking you might do?
I wasn't really thinking about what a career would be at that point. I guess I could have, I thought I might continue and do more campaigns some, but then I saw the people who'd become lifers, and that was a tough life. On these campaigns, when they get going, you're working 100-hour weeks, and you're moving to wherever they need you for 3 months and then moving on. That wasn't something I wanted to, I could see myself doing in the long term. I did it for a while, and then that was, and this, I wouldn't say it was a totally successful experience given all the troubles with the voter file, so it wasn't clear that there was a niche for me there. And then eventually, my dad knows people who are at this Economic Policy Institute. He puts me in touch with them. They hear math major who's worked on campaigns and is interested in policy and think that's actually a good fit for what they do. And so I end up getting a job where half of my job was running their computers and half of my job was being a research assistant.
So what was that like?
It was interesting. I learned a lot. It was kind of my first exposure to how you could do kind of economic policy that wasn't just theory and wasn't to me felt less ideological.
What do you
At the
mean? What?
time, well, so this was, again, this dates itself, but at the time it wasn't totally straightforward to kind of spin up the current population survey and run analyses of it. It was an endeavor. And the Economic Policy Institute put out a book every 2 years called The State of Working America, where they basically spun the CPS and did a bunch of tabulations. And it was just getting the facts out. And it was, they were definitely, they came from a perspective where they were worried about declining wages, they were worried about inequality, but they were the reliable generator of the facts because they had the setup to be able to spin the CPS. And that struck me as really useful.
So even though you've got this political philosophy that, because you said you were progressive, that something about this is refreshing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I like that, actually, when I was in Japan, I had read Myth and Measurement. And
Oh,
I'd also
really?
like that as a kind of, hey, there's a different kind of economics than what I had learned in Ec-10.
So you were, well, it's funny. I can tell a story where a person is a progressive and goes to Ec-10 and then does not become someone that, and then does not become someone that's more grounded in facts and measurement and getting, they might go in the direction of deeper in their own political philosophy, but you don't do that.
Yeah, I think I was interested in empirics and kind of knowing what was true about the world and not just deducing it from theory. And again, this was a different era in economics where the empirical revolution hadn't really taken over yet. There were still a lot of economics was still theory without much evidence. And a lot of the empirical evidence was not very good.
So you stay there, what, a couple of years or 1 year?
A year and a half. And then I decide, I like this. I can see a future in DC in the policy world. And that's an interesting, that's I can see how I could have a role doing policy from a kind of wonkish side. But I decide that if I'm going to rise up in it, I probably need to go to graduate school. I need a credential and I need to learn some statistics. I knew lots of pure math, but I didn't know any statistics. I probably literally couldn't have defined a standard deviation at that time. And I needed a little bit of economics. And so I decided I was going to go get a master's in public policy as a way of building up those skills.
So do you apply broadly, or is it one of the, something about Berkeley draws you to it?
I applied fairly broadly to public policy programs. I applied to my mentors at EPI really wanted me to get a PhD in economics. I was not sold at all, but I let them talk me into applying to one PhD program,
That was
and a bunch
Berkeley.
of MPP programs. No, that was Harvard. I
Oh,
didn't
okay.
get in.
That's right. Marty Feldstein was like, no, he blackballed. He remembered that kid
who
that.
knows? So, but anyway, I applied to MPP programs and decided I wanted to go back to California. And so Berkeley it was.
Well, so, what, so your first econ class at Harvard's like, kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth. What's econ like for you that first year at Berkeley?
So I get to the public policy program thinking, I'm pretty rusty on my math. It's been a few years since
Oh, you're
college.
not doing it
I'm really gonna have to.
simultaneously. You're doing it like you're doing one
Not
and
at
then.
first. I'm just an MPP. There's no plan for a PhD at all at
Oh,
this
you didn't
point.
apply to the econ. You applied just to the
No.
MPP. Got it.
Yeah. And I'm worried that I'm too rusty that I'm gonna have to struggle to get ready for these classes because I haven't done math in a few years. And I walk into the stats class and the professor has read our bios and he looks at me and he says, "Okay, you don't belong in this class. This is not made for math majors." This, most people get public policy master's degrees have not had a math background.
Got it.
They
Okay.
probably haven't had math since high school. So basically I then realized, oh wow, I've showed up to this program where my whole goal was to learn economics and statistics. And the courses it's offering are not ones that I'm gonna get a lot out of. And so I end up going over and looking at the graduate courses in the economics department.
This is 98. This is what, 98?
This was 98.
Okay.
So I sign up for I go to the professor who teaches grad micro, and I say, "Well, look, I missed the first week of classes, but I'm interested because I can't do this in public policy." And he says, "Well, we had a placement test that you missed, but
We
here
have a
you can take it
what?
right now.
We have a
We had a
what?
placement test to let you get into for people who are not in the economics department to get into that class." And he
Which
handed it to
class
me.
was it? Which class was it?
This was grad micro.
Grad micro. Okay. So he's like, if you want to take grad micro, you got to pass this like placement
Yes.
class. Okay.
And he gives it to me, and I was not planning to take a test that day. I just walked into his office, and I sit down, and I work for like 4 hours on it.
What
And
was it?
at
What it
some point, I
was.
wonder. I don't even remember a lot of,
It was just a lot of like constrained optimization stuff that you could do.
that I kind of vaguely knew how to do, but it was a little more applied than the kind of math that I had done in college, and I was rusty anyway. So, and so, I'm not sure I'd ever done a Lagrangian at that point, because in college, it would be a concrete problem if it was in finite dimensions. So anyway, so I sit down, I work for 4 hours. At some point, I think we're probably not supposed to be working this long on this test. And I go back and I said, "Well, I did some of them, but not all of them." And he lets me into the class.
Oh, he lets you in.
I assume basically if you were serious enough to spend time on it, he was willing to let you do it.
There was a hurdle. It was a signal. Got it.
So I end up doing that, and then
So what's that class? Who's teaching that class?
it was Steve Goldman and Chris Shannon
Oh, okay.
in the first
Okay.
semester. So it was a pretty serious theory class. It was Mascalel, Woods, Muldoon, it was and it was a math class, and I could do math classes. And there wasn't a lot of moralizing about policy. It was just doing math. I mean, I enjoyed it and I did well at it. I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do for a career, but it wasn't such a hurdle to get through as I had thought it would be.
Well, were you hearing any economics, or were you hearing math? I mean, what were you, you've not had, you don't have this economics background. So like what's kind of floating up to the top in that class?
I mean, it's lots of theorems about the equivalence between revealed preference and utility functions. And I could work on that. I didn't see it as all that relevant to, should we have free trade with China? or
Right.
whatever the policy questions were of the day, but it was something I could do.
Yeah.
And so I worked, I mean, went way through it. I signed up for the econometrics class,
What'd you think
and it
when you
was
took that
similar.
class?
I was starting to get interesting. It was still no data.
Right.
It was a linear algebra class. And I think we had to do a couple of applied exercises in a language called TSP,
Yeah, I remember that.
but it
We had
was
to do. Yep.
not anything that was really, there was nothing empirical about it. But that was the first time I actually saw what a regression was. I'd never seen a regression before. And so I enjoyed that. And then at some point in that year, I went to talk to David Card
Really? That's the first
and
year?
said,
That's like the or the second.
in the first year, I go to talk to him and say, I'm here, I'm interested in policy, I'm going through these classes, any suggestions? And he said, well, why don't you work for me as a research assistant this summer? And
You feel like you and
that.
him hit it off immediately? There's like a how come? What's it like to hit it off with him? What's the
I mean,
kind of
he's just devoted to getting the facts right, willing to spend his he spent inordinate amounts of time with his students. He was willing to kind of help people learn and really supportive, I found. And willing to hire me to do something that he probably could have done in a day. I spent the whole summer doing it, but he knew I would learn something from it, and that was fine.
So this is
So,
your first, this is kind of like your first moment of data then.
yeah, I mean, I'd done a little bit of data analysis at EPI, but yeah, at EPI, my big project was inverting input output matrices. But this was I'm actually getting the microdata, and he has me doing, put together a data set of a bunch of stacking a bunch of census data sets. At one point, I go to him. He asks me that. He says, "Okay, well, now that we've done this, now we're going to run an instrumental variables regression where we I don't remember what was the instrument or what was the regression." And I say, "Okay, that sounds great, but I don't actually know what instrumental variables is." And he sits down and sketches it out on a piece of paper and spends half an hour teaching it to me, and then I got it. And I don't know that I have the patience to kind of spend that much time with my research assistants teaching them the basics like that. But it was great.
So, I mean, are you getting at that time already? Are you starting to kind of feel like you're getting that like local average treatment effect and the potential outcomes? Or is it like what kind of things could you tell me that, you're noticing now, looking back, that you're kind of getting from Card or from Berkeley?
I think in that first year, it was really just an ethic of getting the facts right and kind of caring about doing the data right. I wasn't getting any of the formalisms yet. In my second or third year, I forget, I took an applied econometrics class that Ken Chay taught, and that was really where we started to get the kind of formal, this is how you do causal inference.
What
He
do you
spent
think? What is the stuff back then that's making an impression on you, particularly when you're taking Ken Chase class?
Yeah, I mean, I think again, it's more the we want to get it right than anything particular about methods. I think Ken spent a lot of time on propensity score matching at that point. That was the hot thing. And so I think, but wasn't particularly about the method. It was about, it matters to get it right. This isn't just a game. We want to get the answer right. And so I think maybe the other thing I was getting at that period was this was also the era of lots of papers with really clever instruments that probably didn't pass any serious investigation. And people would talk about them, but with a fair amount of skepticism. So you kind of learn to have a little bit of to say, hey, look, just because somebody can tell a story doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And let's try to figure out how to evaluate it.
Your peers are talking that way. Your professors are talking that way.
I think that's what you hear in seminars,
The
how do we
clever
know this is right
instrument
kind of thing.
even though it might be replacing a, okay, so this is, you can tell me if I'll play a particular character. So you could, I spoke with Orly Ashenfelter and he said, I remember the day when people would run instrumental variables and they wouldn't even tell you what the instrument was. It was pretty funny, right? And so you can imagine like the clever instrument stage being synonymous with this improvement. But you're kind of saying something a little more subtle. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're saying exactly?
So I think it was an improvement. Better to know, to be told what the instrument was than to not know what it is.
Right.
And that people put a lot of effort into kind of coming up with one where there was a story behind it, as you
Yeah.
could tell. But it was still a little bit too much in the clever. It was kind of too clever by half, and that was the sense that people had that there's lots of stories you could tell, and some of them, they just didn't seem like they passed a smell test. Or they might, the story might make sense, but then if you wanted to do it carefully, you'd need to do it a little bit differently, and people hadn't bothered to do that yet. And so it was just a sense that, how confident should we be that these results are right? I don't know yet. So I can give an example of that from a few years later, but that kind of to me captured the flavor of it. So there were a number of papers that used rainfall in April 1968 as an instrument for whether there were riots after Martin Luther King was killed.
Oh, really? I didn't know
With an
that.
idea, the idea was to try to predict whether a city, what the long-term effect was of riots on kind of urban development. And the theory was that if it rained that week, the people probably stayed home.
Yeah, you can see the thing. Yeah, sure.
And it's a clever idea. It's
Yeah.
a and you know the rainfall in April, rainfall at any given time is reasonably random, and so I think that makes sense. But at least some of the papers at that point were just thinking regressing outcomes in 1990 on whether there was a riot in 1968 with rainfall as an instrument
Okay.
and no controls. Well, rainfall is not randomly assigned across all cities. It's much more likely to rain in April in Memphis than it is in Albuquerque or something like that.
Yeah,
And
sure.
so it would have to do
Oh.
that right, to really make that as good as random. What you'd want to do is control for what fraction of April's it rains in that city. And if you do that, then it's probably pretty as good as random whether it rained that particular April. So it's an idea that could work, but we hadn't really gotten to the point of let's really isolate the randomness yet.
You're talking this way, you're thinking you and your colleagues or your classmates are kind of talking that way. This kind of really scrutinizing the design or scrutinizing the instrument. Is it mainly IV that's getting in your head?
I think that's probably the most common one at that point. Yeah, I think I don't know how much we're coming up with it versus just hearing it a lot, but I do remember that, Orly visited during one of the years I was in grad school, hearing it from David, hearing it from John DiNardo, who visited, hearing it from Hito Imbens, who visited during that period. That I remember hearing a lot of times, okay, so you're doing this analysis. What's the hypothetical experiment that would identify the effect you're interested in? And how does this analysis you're doing approximate that experiment?
As of
And
that's different
that's a
than the
question I remember hearing from Orly, hearing attributed to Orly as,
Oh, that's a
it,
th that
you're
source is
not getting a
probably
causal
Orly.
effect unless there's an experiment that goes with it.
So that's fascinating that that's in. It just seems like everything seems to go back to Orly Ashenfelter that I've heard. So again, I just want to try to understand this though. That to me is directly connected. Okay, so why is that not directly connected with the clever instrument?
Well, I think it is, but we hadn't yet gotten to the point. I think that lesson that causation is only really identified by experiments, by randomization. had not quite fully penetrated into how
Oh,
do you implement it to isolate the randomization.
I see.
And
I
so Orly was
gotcha.
asking the question, but it needed to be asked because a lot of people
Right.
hadn't thought about that question at that point.
Right.
You know, and clearly the people who came up with the rainfall instrument had that idea in mind, but we just hadn't gotten to the point yet where people realized that it wasn't enough to have the idea in mind. You actually had to isolate the
They
randomness.
had to isolate the randomness. Well, that, do you think that even is being coming from that late theorem? Because, prior to everything being framed in the late theorem, you've just got exogenous instruments. But, the late theorem is got this explicit, independence assumption inside it, which is distinct from the exclusion restriction.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know that I had really internalized the late theorem yet. I don't know how much that was around, but it was pretty new at that point. And I don't know how much. Well, for one thing, we were always thinking, you weren't ordinarily thinking of heterogeneous treatment effects as the default assumption. It was perfectly normal to kind of think of constant treatment effects at that period.
So you end up working. Is Card your main advisor?
Card ends up being my main advisor.
What
Yeah.
do you end up working on?
So I ended up writing it. So one of the projects he had me work on as a research assistant was he did a paper with Alan Krueger on the effect of ending affirmative action in California on Black and Hispanic applications to the University of California. And as part of that project, they got data on SAT takers. And so one of the things I did for him was I cleaned that SAT data.
Is that your first paper, your Journal of
I
Econometrics?
wasn't well, so that grew out of that. I was just a research assistant on the Card and Krueger paper. I wasn't a co-author. But at some point I go to David and I say, look, these SAT data are really interesting. There must be, there are a lot of other things you could do with it beyond this question. And he says, well, why don't you go do one of them? And so, tell me what your best ideas are. And the Journal of Econometrics paper grew out of that. It ended up using different data, but it was using SAT data and looking at admissions to the University of California. And then my job market paper was using the SAT data. It was it's called Good Principals or Good Peers.
Oh, yeah, that comes out in
So,
AER. Okay.
yeah, that was a
What is that
study of
paper
school
about?
choice. So
Oh, that's
it's
about a
basically
school choice.
saying. So it's not about an experiment or anything like that. The idea is we have this proposal to let people choose schools. A lot of the argument for it is that is if you create a market in schools, people will choose the better schools, and that will create rewards for schools that are good, and penalties for schools that are bad, and create kind of market incentives for schools to get better. And I was thinking about how that would work, and thought, well, a predicate of that whole chain of logic is that when people choose schools, they're going to choose the good ones. But do parents know what are the good schools? Do they can they identify them? It wasn't so clear to me. And so I
Because
said, well,
back
let's think
then
about
there
how you
wasn't.
could identify.
Well, what would parents have had access to back then?
It's a good question. That was part of
Folklore, just
of
kind
it.
of like a social network or something?
You were just starting to get some versions of accountability that would you could get average test scores at the school level or something like that, but they weren't consistently available or very widely available. And I remember one statistic that stuck with me. California had put out its first test scores around this period, where they'd done testing of students and put them out and put out average scores at the school level. And as part of that, they'd surveyed parents to try to kind of collect some basic demographics. And so they did this survey that had something like a 50% response rate. And based on that survey, they calculated the average education of parents of the school. And one of the statistics that was buried in the report when you looked at it was that the correlation between the average test score of students at the school and the average parent education was 0.94. And I said, okay, that's a fascinating fact. That says to me that whatever we're picking up here, is this really school quality, or is this, or are these test
It's some
scores
sort
just
of
taking out
sorting.
composition?
Yeah. This is the Tebow equilibrium. It's the sorting.
Exactly. Well, yeah. So then I realized that, well, look, there's two explanations for that. One is the test scores are just measuring student family background,
Right.
and they're just doing it well. And so you're not really, it's nothing about the schools at all. It's just which students are at the school.
Yeah.
But the other possibility is that there are good and bad schools, and the parents know about it very well, and the rich and the families with high with more education are making sure their kids go to those schools.
Yeah. Yep.
And so the causation goes from the school quality to the parental education rather than from the parental education to the test scores. And
Oh,
so my job
wow.
market paper was an effort to disentangle those
Wow.
very indirectly.
What did Card think about that paper while he was watching it emerge?
Yeah. So at first I went to him and I said, well, I've got this idea. And he's like, well, hold on to that, but let's keep looking. Maybe we'll come up with a better idea. But then over the next couple of months, I didn't come up with a better idea. And he said, okay, well, let's see what you can do with that one.
Was he pretty impressed when at the final thing? I mean,
I don't know.
was he a hard professor to impress? Was that is that even the right word to think about?
Yeah, I don't even know that I would have known to think about whether he was impressed or not. He certainly gave lots of advice, and it was one of the ideas that I absorbed was that there is no perfect paper, and that that it can always be improved, and certainly my papers can be improved. And he helped a lot with it. But he also, as I've gotten to know him better later, he very clearly kind of matches the advising to what he thinks will benefit the student.
Wow.
And there are some, and there are students, there are papers that might be great in one person's hands, but another student isn't really ever going to be able to pull that off. And that's okay. You just help the student get to do as well as they can.
Why do you think you in particular really benefit from that style of advising?
I don't know. I think at the time I didn't have that much imposter syndrome about it. I knew I could learn, and I knew I had a lot to learn, and I didn't. Somehow, for whatever reason, my ego just didn't get caught up in it as much as it does to me in other settings, or it does to lots of students. And so I could hear the criticism and take it as constructive and not be bruised by it.
You
And I don't
mentioned
know what about that setting made that work, but it worked.
imposter syndrome. That's interesting you bring it up. A lot of people would be amazed to think that you would ever feel that, but that you're saying that that did start to that at later it's something that you did feel a little bit.
Earlier and later, at various times, I've felt it in various settings, but I somehow, maybe because I had never really planned to get a PhD, I just wasn't that emotionally invested in it
Yeah.
and could, and if it worked out, great. If it didn't work out, there were other things I could do.
Yeah,
And I
yeah,
wasn't, I could somehow take in critique and suggestion without feeling bruised by it.
Right. So you end up at Princeton. I mean, what was it like? What was your years like there? I mean,
Yeah.
it lot of really great publications while you're there. How did the whole process feel?
Yeah, I mean, that was the mothership. If you were a David Card student, the kind of it was clear that you were being steeped in this tradition that had started around the counter at the industrial relations section at
Yeah,
Princeton.
totally. Totally. Do
And so,
you have a
all
sense of
the
the history when you got there? Did you have a sense of the
yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, I don't know that I knew all of it, but I had actually, Dave had spent a year on sabbatical there when I was a grad student, and I spent a semester as a grad student there and
Oh.
kind of got a sense of it. And so I knew the people a little bit when I got hired back there.
So what? Orly's there, Kruger's there. Is David Lee
Orly
there?
Kruger. No, David Lee is at Berkeley. He gets hired at Berkeley towards the end of my time in grad school.
Okay.
The CC Rouse is there, Hank Farber, Jeff
Wow.
Kling. And then my first year there as an assistant professor, Alex Moss is on the job market. So he's around.
So y'all
It
become
was a great
close.
place.
You and Moss become close? I know y'all have written a few
Yeah.
times together. He was
Yeah.
he so y'all overlapped a little bit.
He and I keep switching places, but we're now finally in the same place. It's great. But we overlapped for his last year of grad school, my first year as a professor. Then he gets a job at Berkeley and comes out here. Then around in 2009, we both take jobs in the Obama administration. He's in the Department of Labor, and I'm at the Council of Economic Advisors. Then at some point, he gets hired away from Department of Labor to OMB, and I get hired into his job at the OL. And then when we leave Washington, he goes to Princeton, and I go to Berkeley. So, but
So you
now we
made a
finally got him
promise to
back to
him. You're
Berkeley.
like, if you come here to Berkeley, I promise I'll probably stay here this time.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the way it's worked out.
Well,
So,
so this paper, Tipping and the Dynamics of Segregation with
yeah.
Card and Moss, that's a very, very cool paper. Can you tell me where this paper came from?
Sure.
And what's
So,
the, like,
Dave.
for the sake of the listener who doesn't know what it
Yeah.
is, also you can say it also what your the origin and what it's about.
Sure. So Dave and I had been working on residential segregation and school segregation, and we have this paper on segregation and test score gaps, which in modern terms, I guess maybe you could think of it as we're basically using city segregation as a measure, as a instrument for exposure to students of a different race, is roughly what the setup is. But we've obviously been thinking a lot about kind of neighborhood composition and how that varies across places. We've done a lot of building of segregation measures. And at some point we have a conversation and he calls me up and he says, look, I just had this, I've been talking with Alex and he just showed me this fantastic graph and we should do something with it. And the graph was they took neighborhoods in Chicago over a 10-year period. And they plotted the kind of fraction black in the neighborhood in the base year on the x-axis and the change in the fraction black over the next 10 years in the y-axis. And you can see in that graph, it's just a scatter plot, but you can see a clear discontinuity. And that, we don't really have a great story for it, but that's basically the origin for the paper. It's noticing that in a lot of places, you see this, that there's a discontinuous relationship between racial composition of a neighborhood and what happened thereafter.
What was the outcome?
And
What was the outcome around the discontinuity?
so the change in the white population over the next 10 years, say.
Oh, got it. Segregation is you're watching, and what's the cutoff? It's the threat, the running
So
variable is what exactly?
the fraction black in the neighborhood in the base year,
Oh, and then there's a
or the
tipping.
fraction. Yeah, exactly. And so this discontinuity is tipping, that it seems like as long as the black share doesn't get above a certain point, then you get kind of growth in the white population. But if the black share gets above that point, you get fairly catastrophic declines in the white population.
You find this point to be the same in a lot of areas, or is it varying a lot?
As we now start to dig into it, and we find that it does vary some across places, but that it does look like each city has a pretty clearly defined point.
What is it? Like,
And
what's an
we,
example?
so sometimes it's like 8%, sometimes it's like 12%. And part of the paper is doing an analysis of where it's higher and where it's lower. And we connect it to there's a lot of sociological discussion about white flight, about tipping points. Schelling's old model of tipping points was a model of neighborhood segregation. And a lot of these stories have this idea that there is some threshold. And if it gets beyond the threshold, the kind of white families get uncomfortable. And it looked like we had empirical evidence for that.
So what are you going to look at the outcome? You're looking at the, you're looking at segregation coming from the tipping.
Yeah, we're looking at changes in neighborhood composition. I think of segregation as an aggregate statistic, but we're looking at this neighborhood. If this neighborhood goes above the threshold, what happens to it? And I think it's something that, we now talk a lot about pre-specified research designs. Nobody would have pre-specified this design because even if you believe the Schelling model, there wasn't wasn't obvious that the point would be common across lots of different neighborhoods. And if the point varies a lot heterogeneously, then it's going to be very hard to see the kind of patterns we see.
We never would have
said, let's go look for these patterns. But we saw these patterns, and they're pretty interesting and pretty consistent. And so we worked on trying to basically to document that they were there.
Did you face a lot of opposition in getting that paper published or getting people to feel persuaded by it?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, it's basically a descriptive paper. It's just showing that this pattern exists. We're not making causal claims about it, really. It's just, you know,
making a
model that generates this.
Even though it's kind of got the RD flavor to it?
It's kind of got this RD flavor to it, but we didn't, this wasn't something where we had a program and we were looking at whether which side of the discontinuity you're on. We were saying, hey, look, the data show a discontinuity. And we're not, and that was basically it for the paper, showing the data showed a discontinuity. So I think of it as more descriptive than really a kind of causal analysis. You could interpret it as saying, look, it does look like there's some causal effect of going across this threshold. And we kind of, a lot of the methods we used were basically trying to show that they would work, you know, the kind of standard causal techniques would work for this.
They would.
But so like one of the worries you have is that, well, if you're looking for where the threshold is as a place where things change, then it might be too easy to find the threshold because things, you know, just random variation will make it look like there's a change point somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we drew on, there's a literature in time series on change points and on identifying change points. And we drew on that to kind of, as a way of kind of trying to reason about what the kind of false discovery problem would be in this study.
Oh, wow.
We ended up doing a split sample. You can think of it as split sample IV to do it, where we estimate the change point at one sample and then use the other sample to test it to try to avoid, again, finding spurious relationships.
Oh, wow. Huh.
So it was a fun paper.
It was a fun paper?
But it's definitely not... it was not a conventional program evaluation. And I think a lot of the challenges we had with that were in trying to figure out what are the right tools to use in this, for this, how do we even kind of frame this in a paper, given that it wasn't.
Well, so
the question wasn't quite as clearly defined as it might be.
15 years later, you've had all this time to think about it. What do you think this paper's lasting value is then? What do you think you've learned from it, or that, you know, you think there really was something I personally was changed and learned this from it?
Yeah. I mean, so I, you know, again, I think that we really did have real evidence that there was something important about segregation, about composition affecting people's willingness to live in a neighborhood. And I do think it's still pretty strong evidence of that. You know, I think so I think it's valuable on the substance. I think there's also, you know, methodological things that I took away from it. I think we were one of the first papers to try to do what amounted to regression discontinuity in a setting where we had to estimate where the discontinuity was from the data. And I think we developed some tools.
And that's where you're doing this kind of time series thing to rule out these false discontinuities?
Well, both the time series and the split sample thing.
And the split sample thing.
Yeah. Actually, there's a story about that. That we, you know, we knew we had this problem, that there was this possibility that you could find a discontinuity even if there wasn't one, just because if you search over all the points, it's like a false discovery problem.
Yeah.
And there's somebody, I forget who, but somebody suggested we go look at Bruce Hansen's papers on this. And so we go look at a bunch of papers, and there's one that's called like sample splitting as a solution to the kind of, I don't know, to some problem. I don't even remember the name of the title. And I see that title and I think, oh, that's great. That's perfect. Why don't we just do that? We could divide the tracts into two halves and use one half to identify where the tipping point is, and then the other one to test whether there's actually a discontinuity there. And later I'm on this call with David, and he's like, yeah, well, that's not what that is about at all. It's really about trying to split a time series into a pre and a post period. It's a totally different exercise, but it's not a bad idea. And so we
That's a
ended up doing
very
both.
like modern approach. I mean, that's kind of this, isn't that sort of like the stuff you see in the causal forest and the double device machine learning, these sort of splitting these things up like that? But you were doing
Yeah.
it, you almost found it by, you were doing it by accident.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't the first to come up with that idea. I
Sure.
think it showed up in some of the two sample IV papers that Kruger and others were doing in that period. But yeah, I think it was relatively new at that point.
Well, I'm curious about this lab, the California
Yeah.
Policy Lab.
Yeah.
What is this lab?
Yeah, so it's an effort to pair research expertise from the University of California with state and local public agencies in California who have data and have research, important research questions that are important to kind of doing to policy, but who don't have the research expertise to kind of do it themselves. And so we it's
Whose idea was
with
this?
the so it's hard to know exactly where they, ideas don't. Nobody wrote it down first, and then everybody else went from there. So it's some kind of joint development of me, Till Van Vochter, our two executive directors, Evan White and Janie Roundtree, and program officer at the Arnold Foundation, who all, some combination of us in various conversations over the first few months, kind of figured out what it would be. Arnold was then funding a bunch of policy labs, which was an effort to do this, to try to kind of create the opportunity to do quick turnaround program evaluation work for government to try to help improve policy. And we saw an opportunity in California where California was miles behind the rest of the country in terms of making use of its administrative data. But we saw that, in the wake of the tech boom here, there was more interest in data-driven policy and more interest in making use of the data. It was also, there were also technological changes that made it possible that it was no longer, it used to be that government agencies would each have their data in a kind of custom database that was a different format from every other agency's database, and there was no way to get the data out. And we realized that by this point, it was, you now could get the data out, and it was relatively easy to kind of to pull, extract data and link it across agencies and things like that. And so it was an opportunity to build this capacity for the state. And then I guess I'd say another piece of the origin story is a perception that it was increasingly the case that the way you were successful as a PhD student was not by having a good idea, but by finding somebody who would give you data that nobody else had. And that didn't seem good for the profession at all, or good for research. And it meant that, we were rewarding connections, not ideas. And so part of it was an effort to try to create data as a public good, a way for to build data resources that students could use without having to have had those connections themselves, and that would benefit the state.
How has it been? What has it felt like being a part of this thing?
It's been exciting. I think, we were right that there was openness to doing this kind of work in California, that there was a need at the agency level to have some research support, and that the technological barriers weren't going to be a challenge. We were right that there was demand from the academic side. There's still a lot of work to do. It's still harder than it ideally would be to develop data use agreements and to kind of get data linked and to and I've increasingly realized just how many different agencies data is split among and how many you'd need to kind of work with to be able to build the data set you'd want for a project you want. But we've been building towards it, and I think we've done some interesting work along the way.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I was going to talk to you about augmented synthetic control, but I've been talking your ear off for an hour, and I wanted to just kind of conclude.
Okay.
If you could go back in time and maybe talk to that student who's getting nauseous in their own exposure to their own EC10, and you sort of could pull them aside, what do you think that they What do you think you would tell that kid back then, that from your heart, what would you tell that kid?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I would tell them that I think is still true is that economics is a lot more interesting than Econ 101. I think we take all the interesting things about it out to try to make it seem like a simple story. And I think that's a shame. And so I still think we need to work on Econ 101 and trying to make that better reflect the real world and the what economics really is. So that's one thing. But for me, it worked really well to not be so worried about coming up with a path ahead of time. And I think it's fewer students seem to be willing to do that these days, or and I think the world's made it a little bit harder to do that. I don't know that I could have gotten into a PhD program these days without having spent several years building up the resume for it. And that's a shame.
That's great. Well, it's been really nice.
Yeah, it's nice talking to you.
I hope that our paths cross in person and then get to say hey.
Yeah, I'm sorry I talked so much and we didn't get to synthetic control.
Yeah, no. Well, I teach it now all the time and I've really, really
Great.
loved it. I really it's
Great.
packed full that augmented sandpaper is packed full of really interesting stuff, especially the old bias adjustment from Abedy and Edmonds. It's
Yeah.
very cool.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Yeah.
That's my favorite way of thinking about it. There are lots of ways of thinking about it, but I think of it as it's adjusted for observables.
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, it comes full circle. And I'm getting better at teaching it, but I'm curious. I mean, have you had a lot of positive responses to it? Do people, it's got a lot of citations.
Yeah, it's got citations. People seem to be finding it useful. It's amazing how much demand there is for a method that works in this setting. And so I think, I'm still worried that a lot of the settings where we're using it are not settings where we really have a plausible case that we're going to identify causal effects. They're not very promising settings, but they're settings where we really want to estimate something. And I'd rather.
I wonder if I've been teaching it wrong a little bit because I think I started out really drilling on this negative weighting and not being like, kind of like the least negative. But the more I've really linked it back to that Abedy and Edmonds 2011 paper, it just starts fitting with this overall imperfect fit so much better. I mean, you can see the negative weighting, but if you lead with the negative weighting and you don't really think in terms of this like estimating of this put of this potential outcome bias or the or estimating this estimating this bias using I mean it's estimating the bias using the control group in the post-treatment period, right? So it's so it's just like it. It's just
It is.
like it.
It is. And the connection is you only get that bias because you're not willing to accept negative weights in the initial.
Exactly, negative weight. I mean,
Otherwise, if you accept a negative weight to begin with, then you get perfect balance on the observables.
I am kind of curious a little bit. I mean, it does feel like when I've spoken with Alberto, I don't really understand very well in my own words why it ever was the case that we needed that convex hull. So it's like what I don't really fully understand is like, is it coming from, do you think it's coming from something, some sort of important principle? Because I mean, even in your method, it's funny, like it's not as negative as it could be.
Right.
So there's like,
As
what
negative as it could be as
exactly?
OLS, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You could always get it, like you could always get the fit better. So like there must be, what is going on with this? Like, because it's not the same negative weighting you're hearing about with diff and diff. It's this negative weighting of the donor pool unit. And I'm just kind of curious, what's your thoughts on that?
So I guess the analogy I would draw is we still find kind of matching style estimators attractive. Even when you have propensity scores and you can do propensity score weighting, there's something attractive about the intuition about being able to match and say, look, we have a treated observation and here's its statistical twin compared to those two. And but matching is we're only going to allow, weights that add up to one and are all positive. And in matching, you typically would be equal weights. And so there's something attractive about that. About not just throwing it into X prime X inverse X prime Y and letting that go with it, letting that
What do you
run.
think is the attractive part? The fact that we're using comparable units, that something like that, or what is it exactly?
Well,
Because negative
I
weighting
mean,
kind of could take, the whole thing with negative weighting is it's kind of maybe taking you a little bit far away from your treated unit a little bit.
So I think the when you boil down the math behind that intuition, I think it's that extrapolation is dangerous, and that anytime you're doing negative weights, you're basically trying to use the relationship within the control observations to extrapolate outside them, outside of that convex hull. And there's, if you saw a regression where you were controlling for X, but the distribution of X in the treated group and the control group were wildly different from each other, you'd be pretty worried about that. You'd be worried that we can't really successfully control for X. And I think that's the issue that comes up here.
A lot of, it's funny, a lot of this stuff shows up, it just keeps showing up. I mean, the matching, needing common support, synthetic control needing this balance, regression, under unconfoundness, using functional form to estimate counterfactuals. And here, you're kind of, it's kind of, well, you're using an outcome regression, you're using an outcome model to get those, to estimate that bias, right? So you are doing that.
I mean, I think of it as, I'm 25 years into my career and I'm still learning more things about OLS,
I know.
and we're still understanding OLS better. And all of these are just different ways of understanding what OLS does and doesn't do. So yes, we are having to extrapolate, and we are doing some of that. But I think we see this is the minimum extrapolation you need to do a
Yeah,
good
it's
control for
beautiful.
X.
It's really beautiful. I love teaching it.
Thanks.
I love, because
Thanks.
it's like, it just sort of seem, the way I teach it just kind of seamlessly fits, and it helps you kind of immediately, and you kind of realize, you're probably going to need to be open-minded to this, because otherwise certain questions will never be answered.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, Jesse, so much fun to talk. I
Yeah, it was nice
really
talking
loved
to you
it.
too.
Okay. All
Yeah.
right. I'll talk to you
Thanks
later.
a lot.
See
Take
ya.
care.